All right, everyone, welcome back to Computer Science E52. It's been a couple weeks now, nice to see you all again. I hope you all did very well in Quiz Zero and that you didn't find too much trouble with it. Okay, so getting back into substantial matters of the course, learning a few new things. We're going to be talking today about just a couple new things we can add to your toolbox, which will help you address the upcoming problem set 5. We'll be talking first about how to use enumerated types, what exactly those are and why they're useful in different situations. Then moving on to a review of structs, applying structs into the construction of linked lists and the management of linked lists, insertion and deletion from them, as well as file input and output, which will be particularly important in PSET 5, as you'll see soon. Okay, so we'll begin by talking about what enumerated types are. So essentially, whenever we have some type of data type in C, whether it be an integer or a character or a Boolean value, we have this data type. We have this bool, this char, this int. And we also have a finite set of values which can be stored in that data type. So something like an integer, it's less obvious since you have so many values to choose from, but you do have this set, a number of values. You have 2 to the 32 different things which can be stored in that integer, 1, 2, 3, all the way up to 2 to 32. If it's an unsigned int, a signed int, you have negative 2 to the 31 to 2 to 31 minus 1. So with something like a bool, it's a little more obvious. You have this value which can either be true or false. But what if you wanted to have some sort of value stored in memory, and you can have, maybe there's only 3 or 4 different options that you'd like to be stored there. You're not really left with any very helpful options in C other than maybe using something like an integer to store maybe the numbers 0, 1, 2, and 3, and you yourself would comment or remember what exactly each number means. That's a little bit of overkill in a way, because you're not using all these other numbers, and when you look at it, it seems like, well, you know, that's a little abstract. It's not really very helpful to look at these numbers 1, 2, 3 in my code and not know exactly what they mean. So, sure, you could use something like a pound define, where you'd maybe use different words for these constants and then replace them with 1, 2, 3 in your code. But then for every option, you have to define a new constant. You have to do a different pound define statement. And if you get a larger number of things that are linked together, it becomes less obvious in your pound define which ones are linked, which ones aren't, and you end up having to write all these lines of code at the beginning of your file before you even start doing anything. So enumerated types essentially provides a really good solution to this type of situation. So let's take a look at an example of using enumerated types. So in this example, let's take a look at a few different ways where we can use enumeration. So if I wanted to have a variable called outcome, and I wanted the possible values that outcome could be to be maybe win, lose, or draw, 3 different outcomes to some game that I might be writing in the program, then I could write something like enum, followed by in curly braces, the set of values that I want it to be. We'll put them in all caps, just like we would with a pound define statement. So I would have win, lose, draw, separated by commas, and then the name of the variable which I'd like to declare, which can be any of these 3 values. So now I have this variable called outcome, and it can be made to equal win, lose, or draw. I can check against those values and see if it's any of those. I don't need to worry about what number the computer is assigning to each one of them. It is in fact storing them as an integer, 0, 1, and 2, but this is something that's abstracted away that you don't really need to worry about, and you can just use these word values, these constants which are defined here, and conveniently they're tied specifically to this variable, and you don't have to worry about doing any pound define statements to make that work. You just have to have this one line here, and then you have that variable accessible to you. Now, if I wanted to maybe have a specific data type which had these 3 values, like if I wanted to have a bool data type, I could do something like enum bool, which gives me a Boolean data type, and then in these 2 curly braces, I can place the different values I'd want it to be. So I could have true, false, and then followed by a semicolon to declare that data type. Now, if I wanted to refer to it as something other than enum bool, because in this case, much like in a struct, I have to actually write enum bool, I could use a type def, as you've seen elsewhere where we're using structs, or also when if you remember it, when we went over what was in CS50's library, we talked about how string is really just char star. So we did something like type def char star and then string. So anytime we use the word string, what we were really referring to was a char star, a pointer to a character, which allowed us to kind of wave our hands for a while and just say we were using a string without worrying what a pointer is. So if I wanted to do something similar here, then I could take what I had previously, put in, I'll just reset the file, what it was, nano enum.c. Now you see here I have type def enum win lose draw outcome. So I've essentially declared a new type called outcome, which can have values which are at either win, lose, or draw. And this is very convenient because I can treat this just as if I would with any other type. I can, for example, declare a variable called result of type outcome, and then using that number, check it against get a result from a function which also is of return type outcome. As you see here, this is a function not of int, char, or any standard data type. It's actually of outcome. It returns either win, lose, or draw, one of these different values. And then use that as I would normally use any other C data type. So you see it gives you flexibility to really define very specifically what you want your data type to include. So if you have these unique situations where you just need a little, maybe a three or four different types of values and don't want to have to worry about different integers creeping in and having these magic numbers floating around, or maybe a great number of pound define statements, it tends to be gives you a very useful tool to do something like that. So if you look here, what's essentially happening in this program is that we're supposing we have some game around this program wherein the opponent has scored 9,000 points. You get from the user the value of their score. A function of which has return type outcome checks if it is larger than 9,000 or if it is less than 9,000. If it's greater than 9,000, then we return win because intuitively, the user has won if their score is higher. If it's lower than 9,000, they get lose. And in the other case, which would be if it is equal to 9,000, then it's a draw. So the rest of our program is able to handle these values as they're presented. And we can, in a comparison statement, just like we would check the value of any other variable, we can check if it is equal to this constant which we defined and do something specifically as a result of that. And to prove the point, if we were to run enum now and give it a score, 9001, scored over 9,000 and you win. So you can see this has exactly the same effect as if we had used an integer value and just assigned arbitrary meanings to different numbers, but we're able to kind of add a layer of abstraction, not really worry so much about what the numbers actually are by using enumerative tools available to us in the C. Okay, so with that being said, let's move on now to talking a bit about structs. So this was on quiz zero, you may have noticed. I don't know if everyone was extremely comfortable with that on the quiz. Hopefully they had at least some level of comfort and were able to do with what they saw. So let's just talk again about how we would generally declare structs and make use of the values which are kept within them. So essentially in a struct, you're able to keep track of multiple properties or multiple variables which are somehow related to each other. So suppose you wanted to keep track of various properties of some single entity, maybe like in the Sudoku project, we had the board, we had our G struct, our global struct, which we kept track of an X coordinate, a Y coordinate, kept track of the state of the board. All these things were connected somehow, which is why we put them together in a struct. We also saw in the quiz where we had a student struct, and this has also been mentioned in lecture, we had the name of the individual as well as a string containing what house they're in. So essentially to declare a struct like this, you would actually write struct, then the name of whatever structure you wanted to create. So in this case, as on the quiz, we had student, struct student. Then in your curly braces, you would declare all the variables which you want to be contained within the struct. As we did in the quiz, we had not int. It was a string name and string house. So essentially, and also the semicolon following this, easy to forget that. So essentially what we're doing is just creating, if you can think of it as like just a container holding all these other variables, which binds them together in a conceptual way, it's a lot easier than if you had to declare variables for every every single combination. For example, if you didn't have access to structs and you wanted to keep track of a number of students, you might have to have variables named something like student 1, student 2, student 3, or perhaps have an array which contains these. And that would mean you'd have to have multiple arrays which would contain all the students' names, all the students' houses, and you'd have to make sure that they're synchronized perfectly so that each index value corresponds to the index value in the other array, which can be a little tricky and is a little less reliable. If you have something like a struct, you can actually declare an array of structs and keep all this data together and bunch them together like that. Since struct is looked at as a legitimate data type containing these other data types, you can do some very useful things in C with it. So now that we've just taken another look at what exactly structs are, just in a familiar setting, using a topic which was addressed on the quiz itself, I'm going to channel my TF from last year, actually, in the way that he demonstrated structs to us. It's a slightly more nerdy way than this. And it's directly pertaining to what some might call one of the most difficult choices in a young person's life, at least a young person who grew up in the 90s. I don't know if this looks familiar to anyone, but... So the choice that I'm alluding to that many of you are giving me just these blank looks at for bringing up is the choice of what your starter Pokemon would be. So the reason I bring this up is because each of these three Pokemon, Bulbasaur, Charmander, and Squirtle, has a unique name, a unique elemental type, and also a property which corresponds to how many hit points they have or how much damage they can take before in the game they would faint. So you can see that, particularly in this context, relating to these objects or animals or Pokemon in a video game, you can easily see how you'd like to take several variables that are closely linked, the type of the Pokemon, the name of the Pokemon, as well as the health of the Pokemon at the current time, and link these together so that you can reference them in kind of a consistent way. And it makes things a lot simpler programmatically to do this. So let's take a look at how we would implement something related to this particular example. So here you see I've declared a struct called Pokemon. It contains a char star, which you'll remember is the same thing as a string, a char star name, a char star type, and an HP, which just stands for hit points. You don't have to worry about really what that corresponds to. Just know that we're storing a number there as well. So suppose we wanted to write a program which asks the person to give us some information about a particular Pokemon and then store it and give that information back. So what we essentially need to do is declare a particular structure of the type Pokemon, which we declared previously at the top of the file, and then access each of the individual segments of data within that struct directly and alter their values without changing the rest of the struct. So the way we would do this is by declaring maybe a struct Pokemon, as the data type is referred to in C, and calling that starter. So if I wanted to declare a Pokemon struct with the name starter, I write struct Pokemon starter. Note that this is different to how you're normally used to declaring variables in C. You would normally have a one word data type followed by a value. When you're using a struct in this manner, unless you use a type def, which we'll talk about briefly later to consolidate this into one name, you would have to write struct Pokemon in that two-word sequence directly like that, followed by the name, and then you would refer to it as starter later on, as you see we've done. So, at this point in the program, I'm asking for a string from the user, which gives me the name of the Pokemon in question. So, what I do is I store my result from getString in starter.name. When I have a struct and I want to access a subdivision of that struct, one of the pieces of data which is contained within the struct, I use this dot notation. So it's saying, okay, we have this starter. We want to look at the name inside the starter. So we just write starter.name, struct dot whatever data type we want to access, whatever variable we want to access. Data type is not a good way of referring to this. Whatever piece of information we want to access, whatever variable is contained within the struct. And then we can assign directly to it just like this, as long as we have this direct value reference to the struct. So you see here, I get the string from the user. I assign it to that name. I do something very similar when I'm getting the type. I'm just getting it as a string and storing it there. All starter Pokemon should start with the same HP in terms of game balance, so we're just going to set that directly to 20. We won't let the user change that. We do a quick judgment check to make sure that the user is choosing wisely. And then you see here, we use a similar reference to the local struct, we'll just say Poke, since we've already used the word Pokemon and to avoid any confusion. And by referencing them by value as well, poke.name, poke.type, poke.hp, we're able to print these to the screen. And just as a demonstration of this, we'll go ahead and run structs. And I ask, which Pokemon do we want? We'll, of course, pick Charmander. Which type is the Pokemon again? It's fire. And here you see that we were successfully able to store these two values within the struct, and it was able to print them back to us by referring to it with the struct name, a period, followed by the variable in the struct that we wanted to access. Now, suppose you don't always have access to the struct directly, because sometimes, obviously, we're going to want to pass these structs around between functions. This may not be entirely obvious, but when we start talking about things like linked lists, it's going to be clear how we can take these structs and implement them into larger data structures. When you're putting all this related information together, it's very likely that you're going to want to try to access it again later in the future, and you're probably going to use something like malloc to dynamically allocate memory and keep track of a pointer to this so that you can use it in different functions and not have to worry about losing it on the stack. So in that case, where we're normally writing something like maybe a starter for representing that particular Pokemon struct, dot whatever we're trying to access, if we only had a pointer to it, it would seem like we'd have to dereference the pointer first before we were able to use the dot notation to get to anything. So in that case, suppose I had a pointer to student, for example, and we'll just say the pointer is P, and P just happens to be a pointer which points to student, then I'd have to dereference it with this dereference operator, and then use the dot notation, because I'm referring to it by value at this point, and write whatever variable I want to get access to, and then do whatever I want with it here. So there's actually, since this is such a common thing to do, trying to access a struct from a pointer and then change the value it's stored there, we have a separate notation, which is exactly the same as this notation. So if I want to take a struct pointer and get direct access to one of the values in the struct which is being pointed to, what I can actually do is use this arrow operator. And this is exactly equivalent to this above. So you see here where I had a pointer to a struct, I had to dereference it, and then access one of the values contained therein. I can simply use the pointer, write this arrow operator, followed by the name of the value, and it's the exact same thing. These are precisely equivalent. There's nothing different going on under the hood at all. It's just a different way of writing it. It's a little more convenient and intuitive to look at. You don't have to worry about the reference operator. It just is meant to give you a clue into exactly what's happening there. And if anyone's curious how you would write this arrow symbol, if there's like a particular keyboard combination you have to type in, it's actually just what it looks like. It's just a dash followed by this greater than symbol, this right angle bracket. So to demonstrate how that works, we'll look at the same program, but subtly altered so that we're using a pointer to this Pokemon structure rather than referring to it directly. In this particular program, we're actually just using it within the main function, but if we were actually to take this seriously and implement a larger program in the Pokemon game, then we would, of course, be passing these structures around to different functions, and we'd have to worry about keeping them somewhere separate in memory so we'd continually have access to it. So this is just a good example of what we'd probably actually be doing in a situation like this. So you see here that I'm no longer declaring just a regular struct called starter. I'm declaring a pointer to a struct called starter. So I'm allocating dynamically using malloc something that is the size of, which gets the number of bytes, if you'll recall from a couple weeks ago, of struct Pokemon. I can refer there to struct Pokemon, this two-word reference, as just a regular data type. This will actually resolve to the size of struct Pokemon, wherever that may be. It's a combination of the variable types that are written above. Don't try to just do it manually because sometimes the computer does do some things with padding, just alignment issues. You don't have to worry about that right now. But just that it's better style also to write size of and then whatever you're actually allocating so that you get exactly what you need from malloc. So you see now we're dealing with a pointer. So we have to go to everywhere where we were previously using that dot notation and think about whether we need to change anything. So here we were previously using a dot and you see it's been changed to an arrow because we're actually looking at a pointer to a struct, so we use this arrow notation, which means we're dereferencing the pointer, actually getting the struct itself, which contains the values, or will contain the values we want, and assigning to name get string, so we're able to still type in the name, and it'll assign it by going through that pointer, dereferencing it, and going to that particular variable. We do the exact same thing getting the Pokemon's type, By writing starter arrow HP, we're able to dereference starter again and go straight to the HP value and assign it something using assignment operator. Very simple. Note that when we are using print Pokemon, since print Pokemon is a function which we have not changed and have just kept constant, if we want to be able to reference it by value like we've been doing here without by just using our dot notation, we treat it as a struct. So what we're passing to it is the value, the struct itself, which is being pointed to. So we're using this dereference operator. Does that make sense to everyone? So essentially, while we're using a pointer in this function, since we have this print Pokemon function which already exists and expects to take in a struct itself, not a pointer to a struct, we are able to dereference this pointer. So it goes from the region in memory, if you'll recall, which stores the address of the struct, which is here, and it contains a name, a type, and an HP value, an integer. And we just have this pointer, which tells us where this lives in memory. So when we dereference it, what we're actually doing is going here and getting this entire structure. So that's what's happening when we're passing star starter into that function, which allows us to use the dot notation, where here you see we need to use the arrow notation since we're referring to it as a pointer. Doing the same judgment check by using the arrow notation once again, because we are dealing with a pointer. And you should see that this effectively does work exactly the same. And we end up getting the same result. We're doing the essentially the same thing functionally, but we're dynamically allocating the Pokemon struct. It's no longer being kept on the stack, just that this value we're keeping around, we're dynamically allocating memory on the heap, storing the information there and making use of a pointer. And to reference the values in the pointer, we're using this arrow notation. Or if you want to think about it in terms of what's actually going on, we're dereferencing the pointer and then accessing a value within it like that. Does that make sense to everyone? That's kind of a lot of information, and it's just very pertinent to what we'll be talking about in a moment with linked lists. So if there's any further questions on structs? Okay. So that being said, let's talk a little bit about how linked lists work. So linked lists are essentially an alternative way to keep track of, you could think of it kind of like an array of information. And the reason we would sometimes want to use arrays instead of, or rather linked lists in place of an array, is that if you think of an array, it's just this contiguous region of memory. It's very static. You declare your array, maybe you get 10 spots. Or maybe you get 7 spots, depending on how many boxes you draw. And this is just a rigid region of memory. If you have the numbers 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and I wanted to add the number 7, well, that's kind of too bad because I only declared an array of 7 elements. And if I wanted to have an array of 8 elements now and add 7, I'd have to declare a new array. I'd have to copy over all the elements from the old array. And if I wanted to delete something from this, well, that's also kind of too bad because I'd have to declare a smaller array. I'd have to copy over everything except for the 3. I'd have to move these ahead to a different index number, so I'd be skipping over things and copying them. And it's just a little labor intensive. You're asking the computer essentially to go through everything and copy everything to a new array if you want to make it smaller or larger. So if you want to have a more dynamic way of storing different values and then what you can do is use something like a linked list. And a linked list makes use of structures which contain values as well as pointers which point to, well, we'll talk about singly linked lists for right now. So a singly linked node would contain not only a value which is being stored, but a pointer to the next node in the singly linked list. So if you can imagine, we have struct node. It contains an integer value and then a pointer to something just like itself. And we'll call it next. So if you think about what we have here, we have a capability to store a number as well as the location of another member of our linked list. So if you can imagine, we have a starting point. This is just the base of our linked list. It tells us where our first node is. And then it points to the first node, which contains a value as well as a pointer. So let's say just has the number 4 here, and then a pointer to the next element of the linked list. So we'd go from here to the next element, which is another struct node. This contains maybe 5. And maybe we only have these 2 nodes on the linked list at this point, so we would want to set the next pointer to null, just meaning that it doesn't point to anything and that this is the end of the linked list. So if I have a structure like this, it seems a little less rigid. Why is that useful? Well, the reason it's useful is because if I wanted to get rid of this 4, for example, I no longer want it in my list, that's fine. I just go to where the 4 is, I see what's pointing to it, I see what this is pointing to, so I know what's on either side, and these are just being dynamically stored somewhere in memory. They're not necessarily contiguously stored like an array is, and it doesn't really matter if they are or not, just by the nature of how we're doing things. Then I could look here, I could change this value so that it points not at this node, but at this one. I could go here. Well, actually, yeah, no, that's it, isn't it? We don't have to worry about anything anymore because this node is no longer being pointed to. So it's no longer really part of the list. I mean, it's also pointing to 5, but since nothing's pointing to it, we can't get to it and it doesn't really matter anymore. It's pretty much completely irrelevant. Is there anything else that needs to be done? Or can we just like move on from this 4 node and not really worry about its existence anymore? There is one more thing. This node was dynamically allocated, so it's still taking up a region in memory, and just because we're not pointing to it anymore doesn't mean that it's not still there taking up space, being reserved for the computer. So we do need to remember to free this whenever we're dealing with a situation we're taking out of a linked list. Since we don't need this anymore, we can tell the computer that we don't need to keep track of it in memory, and that lets us use the space for different purposes. So that's conceptually how you would handle deletion from a linked list. So what if I wanted to put something in here now? Maybe I wanted to put the number 6 right at the beginning of the list. Why would I want to put it at the beginning of the list? Let's assume that I don't really care if this is sorted for the time being. Obviously, if I want it to be sorted, I want to put 6 after 5. But is there any benefit from sticking things right at the beginning? It seems like it'd be simple to go to the end and then change this null pointer so it points to the next thing, and I wouldn't really have to worry about like switching too many pointers around to point to the new thing and then have that point to something else. I'd just plop that in the end and make it set to null. So that would require me to go all the way through my list. If I had maybe 1,000 elements in my linked list, it'd be running in linear time because it has to iterate over each of those different nodes before it gets to the end and then places it at the end. If I were to stick it right at the head of the list, which linked lists, by virtue of the way they're organized, I have the power to do, then I just have to go here, put it there, and it runs essentially in constant time. So suppose I wanted to take a node with the value 6 in it and place it right at the head of the list. Then, okay, so I'd make this structure, and I'm writing it between these two because I'm going to place it there in the list, but also just keep in mind that in the computer's memory, this could be absolutely anywhere. These might not be anywhere near each other. They might be right next to each other. They might be in the other order. They might be in this order. It doesn't really matter because we're just pointing to the exit element in the list as we have it conceptually organized, not as it's actually organized in memory, and that's not something you need to really worry about too much. So we declare this value to be 6, and then we have this pointer. So what we'd essentially do is find out by looking here to the first node that's in the list currently, where exactly it's pointing. It's pointing to the first node. So we'd want to make our structure in such a way that it's also pointing to this node. So it takes whatever value is in this starter pointer and gives it to our next pointer within the struct we want to place at the head. And then all that's left to do is change this starter pointer, which tells us where the beginning of our linked list is, and point it toward the first node that we want to place in our list. And so we were just able to insert a new value into our linked list in constant time, very simply relatively easily and programmatically simply as well. So let's take a look at an example of a C implementation of just a very simple linked list, just so that, because obviously looking at this, it kind of makes sense conceptually, but it doesn't necessarily lend itself to how you would do it programmatically. So I'd like to expose you a little bit to some of the potential ways you could write functions which would do things like this. So we'll take a look at linkedLists.c. In this case, we're once again looking at a singly linked list. So we're declaring a struct. We're calling it SLNode, a singly linked node. And we're storing an integer called value. So we can store any integer in this linked list. You could obviously place really anything there. If you wanted to have a linked list which contains strings, if you wanted to have a linked list which contains characters for whatever reason, or even Boolean values, although I can't actually imagine any reason you'd want to do that. You could do that. You can store anything you want in these nodes. All that's important for a linked list is that you also have some kind of node pointer, which tells you where another node in the list is so that you can keep them linked some way. So you'll see here that this pointer is of typed struct SL node. Once again, when we're dealing with structs in this manner, unless we've type defined the struct to correspond to a different name we can refer to it as, we do have to write struct SL node. And the obviously the asterisk indicates it's a pointer to that type, and we're calling it next. So just skipping over these helper functions for just a moment, I'll just reveal what we're essentially trying to do in this program so you have a kind of a little bit of context before we just start dealing with the code and all the pointers and start potentially getting slightly lost. We have a function called append, and above all these calls to append, you see that we're declaring a pointer, struct lnode star list. Obviously, list isn't really a struct SLNode. It's just a pointer to one of those structs. It's essentially what I'm representing in this box here. Anytime you have a linked list, you, of course, need to keep track of where it starts. You can't really just have this first struct declared in your main function, because then it'd be part of the stack, and that kind of sort of defeats the purpose of allocating the memory directly and having this dynamic linked list stored somewhere in the heap. So we just have to maintain this pointer to the beginning of the list just so we can keep track of where part of it is in memory and access the rest through that. So we declare a pointer of the type struct SL node. We call it list, and it's initially set to null, because before we add anything to our linked list, this is just a pointer which points to nothing. It's just a placeholder so that we can later keep track of these nodes and where they're located in memory. So what essentially we're trying to do, when the function name is very suggestive of this, is that we're just appending to this linked list all these different numbers, 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, 42. When I say append, I mean literally, so we go to the end of the linked list each time. This is what I was talking about before, which is a little less effective in terms of runtime, but just for the benefit of the example, it's very simple code, something we can do very quickly and easily, and also it'll correspond in our calls to the order the numbers are seen later in terms of print list, so it's easy to see that it did work the way we described. So let's take a look at this append code, so we can see how we'd navigate a linked list and then add values to it somehow by adding nodes. So up here in the comment for the function, you see we're just inserting a new value at the end of a singly linked list. We're just getting a new value which we want to place in there somewhere, as well as this is slightly outdated. It's not actually a node pointer. We're dealing with a pointer to a pointer. So when you see this double star notation, what it's essentially saying is that this is a pointer to a struct SLNode pointer. So since we need to keep track of where this is in memory so that we can change its value directly and make use of it, we actually have to have a pointer to this pointer. And that obviously lends itself to a little bit of confusion. So if you can imagine, if we were to just pass the value of this to the function, we'd really just be passing a null value. But if we were instead to pass the address of this, we'd be able to change it directly and then make use of it later. So what we're essentially doing is taking a pointer to this, and since it's one additional level of indirection, we add an asterisk and just simply say that it's a pointer to a pointer. Don't worry about that too much. Just try to take it a little on faith so that we can deal with implementing the rest of this. But if you do stare at it for a little, I promise that it starts to make more sense. It's just something that right now is a little tricky because obviously pointers were thrown at you just a couple weeks ago, and I'm sure you're still wrestling with it slightly conceptually. So essentially what we're doing first and foremost is creating a pointer to a new node. We're allocating space and memory to keep this node, just like we did here. We had to allocate space and memory to contain the value in the node as well as the next pointer. So we're allocating space and memory to keep this entire thing. And then malloc, as you remember, returns a pointer to that. So we have a pointer to our new node, which is being returned by malloc. We're making sure that this is not equal to null, because as you may remember, when malloc is unable to allocate memory, it returns this null value. And we have to keep a lookout for that, because if that happens, it means something has gone horribly wrong and we need to return, because if we start messing with it later, we're just going to get a seg fault. And it's much better to exit gracefully now and return an error message, which is a little more informative. So you see here, we're once again making use of this arrow notation using this arrow operator. We have a pointer to a node, and we want to access the value in it, value being the variable which contains the number. So by using a new node arrow val, we're able to dereference the pointer to our singly linked node, which is called new node, go to the value space in that structure, and assign to it the new val value which has been passed to this function. So new val could be something like 4, 5, 6, whatever we wanted to place within this node and append to the list, and that's being assigned to this to the value variable in this struct. We're assigning the next variable, which is a pointer in itself, to another node, to null. Does it make sense why we're doing that? Why would we make it null? Is it going to stay null? Is that something that we're going to keep it as? Or is it just a placeholder now as good practice to before we change it to something else? Sorry?
So there's no junk in there.
Yeah, that's always a good reason to do this. Whenever you declare a pointer, if you're not going to use it for a little while, it's probably a good idea to set it to null just to make sure you're not using it improperly later. You'll get a warning from the compiler when it's null. In this case, we actually are not going to be changing again by virtue of the fact that since we're appending, adding to the end of the linked list, we know that we want it to point to null because we're not going to be pointing to an additional node right away. So there's really two good reasons to do that, and we're making use of both, essentially. So we're checking on, right here we're checking if star list star equals null. So you'll remember that list star was actually this pointer to our pointer. So we're saying star list star. So we're dereferencing this one time. We're going down here, and we're checking if it's equal to null. So we're looking at where the actual pointer to the start of our list is and checking if it equals null. What does it mean if it equals null? What are we actually doing here substantially? If it's equal to null, that means we currently have nothing in our list. We're not pointing to a node at that point. The reason we have to check for this is because if we didn't, you'll see that we're going down here and we're assigning this to the struct pointer list pointer, and then we start trying to access the next value which is kept in this struct which we're pointing to. So if we tried to access the next value in a struct that's being pointed to and the struct that is being pointed to is actually null, we end up getting a segmentation fault. Because if you try to access a struct value that is kept in a struct which is apparently at the zero memory address or at null, you get a segmentation fault because you shouldn't be doing anything with null ever, because you have no permission in C to do anything with that null memory location. It's essentially there to indicate that this pointer is not pointing to anything, and you can't do anything with any values which you might imply are contained there, because there is nothing there and it's not something you have permission to access. So we have to necessarily check if this pointer is set to null, and if it is, then we just change that pointer so it points to our new node, and we make it the head of our linked list, and it'll be the only value which is stored there presently. If we get by this, since we're returning if this is true, we can assume that our list start does in fact point to a singly linked node. And see here, we're just using another variable name just to remove a layer of that abstraction. We're dereferencing list start. So we're going here, And we're making a, we're giving a, the value which is contained here, whatever this is pointing to a pointer called list pointer. So list pointer now you'll see is pointing to the beginning of our singly linked list. And we know it's pointing to the beginning, which is in fact a node, because we checked before to make sure that this wasn't null by doing something separately. So again, just because that's kind of a tricky little statement we're making, we're dereferencing list start, we're removing one layer of indirect reference, going here to this pointer, getting the value, whatever this is pointing to, whatever this memory address is, assuming we have one here already, at least one, that's all that matters. We're getting this memory address from here because that's the value here. It's this memory address. And we're declaring another pointer, list pointer, to point to that. So this allows us just to make use of this reference to the first node in our linked list without worrying about the second layer of indirect reference, which is forced upon us by the way we had to handle that first condition. So here's a handy little line of code. What's going on here? While list pointer arrow next does not equal null, set link pointer to list pointer, or list pointer to list pointer arrow next. And right after this, we're appending our new node. So what do you suspect that this loop is taking care of? So list pointer right now is pointing to this first node in our linked list. Let's assume we have the 6 and the 5 here just because it's already on the board. List pointer is pointing right here. This is in fact the value of our list pointer now since we just took it from the dereference of list start. And we're checking that it's not equal to null. It's not equal to null right now because it points to this structure. Then we're taking list pointer and we're setting it to list pointer arrow next. So when we have the arrow notation, we're taking list pointer, we're dereferencing it, we're going here, we're getting dot next, we're going to this next value, which is the pointer to the next struct node, and we're setting list pointer equal to that address. So now this, which is, and this is not representative of this original pointer because we maintained that, remember. This is just a, let's in fact say we have list pointer here. This is list start, this is list pointer, it just happens to point to this right now. List start still points to that. And now list pointer is looking here, seeing what that points to, and changing to point to that. So what essentially is happening is we're traversing the linked list. We're finding out what this points to and jumping to that now. So rather than pointing at this first node, we're now pointing at the second node. So now we enter the second iteration of the loop. Let's check, is list pointer arrow next equal to null now? It is. So the reason for that is list pointer is here. We're dereferencing it because that's what is implied by the arrow notation. So we're going down here. We're checking what's stored next. And this doesn't point to anything. It's set to null because it's the last element in the list. And now what we're doing is appending our new node because we're now exiting the loop. And we're setting list pointer, dereferencing that, going here to this our last node in the linked list. And we're setting next to new node. So this new node, which we already declared, we allocated space for and we put the value in. We had this null value and whatever our number was, maybe another 6. I'll make it a 4, so it's unique. And we're changing this so that it points here to this pointer that was returned by malloc, which tells us where this is in memory. And we've successfully appended that to the end of the linked list. Does everyone understand why that happens? Is there any part of the code which is a little abstract and doesn't? Okay. And just to demonstrate that this does in fact have the desired results, we can do this print list function, which similarly to before, while list pointer does not equal null, it traverses the list by taking this list pointer, which just is a pointer which looks at each node as it moves through it, and does something for each node, then jumps to the next node, and does something similarly for that until it gets to the end when list pointer is equal to null and stops. This allows us to go to each node in our singly linked list and print out a value. So if you'll remember, we had the numbers 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, and 42. So if we were to run this right now, we would in fact end up with the values 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, and 42, which are all contained within nodes, which were dynamically allocated by malloc and then linked together within structs. And then we were able to traverse them and get the values back again. And once again, the reason for this is that it gives us a little more flexibility to change our data structures and store different types of values than an array would normally allow us to do. Okay. So is everyone more or less comfortable with that at least? Okay. So one more thing just to touch on briefly in terms of linked lists. I'm not going to do a full demo on it since a lot of the concepts are similar. It's just a slightly more advanced type of list. You could potentially conceive of something similar, but which would allow you to go back. So that would be a doubly linked list. So rather than just keeping track of a pointer to the next element or node in the linked list, it would keep track of the one ahead of it as well as the one behind it. So if you think of perhaps a struct called DL node, a doubly linked node, and it would contain pointer to a struct DL node called previous. Once again, another integer value. And then a struct DL node pointer called next. And what this essentially would allow you to do is splice things in that point both to the previous node as well as the next node. And this allows you not only to traverse the list in one direction, but go backward if you need to for some reason. Does that make more or less sense to everyone here? Okay. Now, we have a little time left, so thankfully this next demo is somewhat brief. We're going to talk about file input and output. This is something which we can probably cover in just the few minutes we have left, but it's also something that's very important to our next PSET, where we're going to be looking at files directly and trying to recognize different types of image files. So essentially in C, what you have the power to do, just like you'd create a pointer to a data type which you had made yourself or which you had access to in memory within your program, you can have a pointer which points to an external file and then do things with that file. So you can imagine some programs which you use all the time which make use of outside files and edit them and change them. One example is Nano itself. Nano is a program which takes an input from the user and then changes a text file and allows you to place things in that text file, to delete them from it, and then gives you this file that's left over that you can use independently of Nano with any other text editor or text viewer. So I wasn't able to implement something quite as fancy as Nano, but I did put together what is perhaps the worst text editor ever made, and I called it typewriter.c. So what essentially is happening in typewriter.c is that it's taking input in the form of strings from the user, sending them to a text file one line at a time, and keeping them there, and unfortunately you can't change them again, but you know that's much like a typewriter, so it's perhaps aptly named. So what you see happening here is that we're declaring a file pointer, I just named it paper, we're calling a function called fopen, and these arguments taken by fopen, which of course stands for file open, are a string, which is going to be the name of the file that's being opened. Output.txt may not exist at the time this program is being run, but it'll be created. You see I have a string here called just with a W in it. That means it's writable. We can write things out to that file. If I had made that R, it would mean we could only read from it, and it would prevent the user from potentially overwriting things in the file that we wouldn't want to overwrite as a layer of protection. We, of course, need to check, just as we would in malloc, if this file pointer is equal to null. Obviously, if we cannot open the file, we can't really do anything else in the program, so we'd want to return gracefully rather than get some ugly error, just to give us a little more information on what happened and help the user with diagnosing the problem, and also helping you diagnose the problem while you're writing your program. And then you see I have a while true loop here, just something that continues infinitely until I break out of the loop in whatever way I choose to. What's essentially going on here is we're getting a string value called input, using the function getString, using string compare to check if it's exit. All that's doing is making sure that when the user types in exit, they can actually exit the program. And you'll see when that happens, I'm running a function called fclosePaper. And what that essentially means is take this file pointer and just note that I'm no longer going to be using that file. You can just close off that file for the moment. I don't need to make access of it anymore, and you don't need to remember which part of the file I'm currently at, because it's irrelevant at this point. And just as you'd free any memory you dynamically allocated, anytime you open a file, you should also close it. It's just good form. Otherwise, I'll do the normal behavior of the program, which is using fputs. And what fputs does is writes out a line to the file. So essentially, it takes in a string and a file pointer. This string is input. So it's taking this string input, and it's writing out to the file. So it's just adding whatever. If you're dealing with a text document, it's just a bunch of characters, and it's putting those in the file. If it weren't actually a text document, maybe it were an image, and you were writing bits and bytes to it, which represented maybe pixels or something else, which you will be dealing with very soon, so keep this in mind. And to repeat, if you were just writing out bits and bytes which represented pixels, you would also use fputs to put those into the file. It doesn't matter what type of information it is, it just goes in there. All files are essentially just bits and bytes that can be written and read out. In this case, we're just using text for simplicity. You use fputs to do that. And then you'll also note that I'm using fputs to put a new line character in. Fputs, if you put in a string, is not going to actually insert a new line character for you. It just puts the bits and bytes into the file which you've provided it. And then just for effect here, to really stay with the typewriter theme, I'm printing out to the user "bra-ching" after each line is typed, as if it were a carriage return happening. So if you wanted to see an actual demonstration of this in action, for whatever reason, you have typewriter. It takes in a string from the user. This is line one. Hit enter. We have a little feedback just to let us know that we're on to our next line. This is line two. This is the last line. And then if you remember, I can type exit, and I just set up a condition so I can leave the program at this point. Just leave it gracefully. And now if I look, I have this extra file, output.txt. And I was indeed able to generate this file through my program without actually making it myself outside of the program. And if I open this up in Nano now, you'll see that I was actually successfully able to output this is line one, this is line two, and this is the last line to this file. And if I were to use different arguments to fopen, I could have been able to move to the end of this file and do other things to essentially append information to it, as it were, with just that W provided. If I were to do something now, I would just be overwriting everything here. But do keep in mind there's different ways to use fopen for different behaviors that you're going to want to use. And if you want to learn about some more different file pointer operations which can be used in C, just take a look at the man pages for file pointers. Maybe open things up like man fopen and just take a look at some of the different things that are available there, and also in the problem set PDF, since there's a lot of functions that you're going to be wanting to make use of in this next problem set, which deals in a great deal with file input and output. And with that, we're done for the week. Good luck on the next problem set, everybody, and I'll see you next week.